us to see three things from this passage, three things that are there very clearly laid out. And I bring these out specifically for this purpose, that these things might equip us to live a holy life to God. Do you know the Christian life begins here? The Christian life begins with us grasping certain truths. As I've said before, the Christian life isn't a list of do's and don'ts. Not like Islam. You become a Muslim, you're immediately told, here are the do's and here are the don'ts, follow this, and you're a Muslim because it's all about rules. Hinduism the same, it's all about rules. But Christianity isn't like that. Biblical Christianity, first of all, says, here are truths, grasp these truths. Lay hold of these truths. Make sure you've got them firmly fixed in your mind and in your heart. And make sure that these wonderful truths determine how you think, how you speak, how you pray, how you relate to others. So we're going to look at certain truths this evening. And I urge you to lay hold of them. And to make sure that your prayer life, your daily life, is governed by these rules. Three things then this evening we see from this passage. And the first is this. This passage tells us that God controls all of human history. God controls all of human history. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And in his dream, he sees this image. We don't know how big it was, but he sees this image, quite obviously, of a man. And its head is of gold, and its chest is of silver, and its belly and thighs are of bronze, and its legs are of metal, and its feet are of metal, of iron, mixed with clay. And he doesn't know what this is about. I mean, you have a dream like this, and what's going on here? And of course, one of the things that you find in Eastern culture is the moment somebody has a dream, they immediately think, God is speaking to me. I must have an interpretation of this dream. Do you know, if you go to Asia today, particularly go to India, there are people who have set themselves up as interpreters of dreams. And you can go into Mumbai, Delhi, and there are these people, and the signs are there, very clearly. There's a name given to them, and there they are, interpreter of dreams. And you go and you speak to this person, and you say, I've had a dream, and I need it. And he says, well, you give me 100 rupees, and I'll tell you the meaning of your dream. And people do this. These people make a lot of money. They're in business. And Nebuchadnezzar doesn't just say, well, I've had a dream and it doesn't really matter what it's about, probably Freudian or something like that. He's not like that. He wants to know the interpretation. He takes it seriously. And finally, Daniel gives him this interpretation. And Daniel says, what that dream is telling you is how things are going to work out over the next 1,000 years. That's what he says to this man, Nebuchadnezzar, that over the next centuries, roughly speaking, maybe not exactly 1,000 years, but roughly speaking, 1,000 years of history has been revealed to you. You are looking at how things are going to work out over the next 1,000 years. And he says, you saw this image which had a head of gold. And he says, that is you, that is the Babylonian kingdom. And he says, this is where we are today, as it were. We are living in the age of the Babylonian kingdom. He says, you are the head of gold. And he says to him, but one day, the Babylonian kingdom will fall. I don't know what Nebuchadnezzar made of that, because all he could see was the grandeur of the Babylonian kingdom. And it probably never occurred to him that one day this kingdom will fall. And Daniel says to him, one day this kingdom will fall. And another kingdom will come into its place. And that kingdom is represented by the chest and arms of silver. Now history tells us that that was the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. In fact, later in Daniel, we read when the passage with the writing on the wall, and it says, that very night, the kingdom was given to Cyrus, king of the Medes. So Daniel says to him, one day the Babylonian kingdom will come to an end, and another kingdom will replace it and will conquer the same territory that you have, and that is the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. And he says to him, that kingdom also will one day come to an end, and a third kingdom will come into its place, represented by the belly and the thigh, or thighs of bronze. And again, history tells us, and we read this in the book of Daniel, we will come to this passage where he has this vision of a goat coming, and there are these fighting going on, and it is identified there as the Greek Empire. And he is told that after the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians will come the Greek Empire. And then he's told that empire will come to an end, and a fourth kingdom will come into its place. And history tells us that the Roman Empire came. So the Babylonian Empire, the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks and the Romans. Now, clearly, there is a message here to Nebuchadnezzar, that God is in charge of human history. God controls human history. You sometimes look at the world, and you look at the nations of the world and how things are going, and you wonder, is anybody in control? And this is why some of these philosophers, they say, well, if there is a God, he has just set things in motion, like you wind up a clock and then it just runs by itself. He has set things in motion and things are just going on by themselves. Nobody is in control. If you're a Hindu, by the way, this is standard Hindu teaching. If you're a Hindu, you say to yourself, or your guru tells you, that God did create everything, but then he got distracted by various other things. And so God is distracted, and while God is distracted, the world goes on, but there's nobody in charge. And so whatever nation becomes prominent, well, that's just how it is, but there's nobody in charge. But here is Daniel saying to him, God actually arranges all things. You may look at this nation, and you may feel very, very distressed about this nation. And I can understand that, because you probably grew up many years ago and you saw how things were in this country in the 50s, 60s, 70s. I don't want to age you too much, but I'm sure you can, you know, if you look back far enough, you can see a time when this book, although everybody might not know it, and they weren't all born again Christians, but you remember a time when the teaching of this book and the practices of this book, they were honored, and people sought to live their lives by this book. And if they departed from this book, they certainly didn't parade their rebellion, but they were ashamed of it. And you could, broadly speaking, say we live in a Christian country, in a country where the God of the Bible is honored and his word is honored. And then you look at us today and you think, what's going on? It's almost like this nation has, it's just running away, hurtling, out of control. Nobody's in charge. It's like a bus where the driver's had a heart attack or has fallen out or something, and the bus is just hurtling downhill, totally out of control. You think, what's going on? I remember one time traveling in Nairobi and the bus driver fell asleep. Fortunately, we were in the desert, so there was this road with sand on either side. And the first time we realized that the driver had fallen asleep is because we realized he had left the road and was driving around. We started shouting and he woke up, oh yeah, yeah, and he took us back on the road. And you sometimes feel, is this what has happened? And I say to you, take hold of this truth and keep it firmly fixed in your mind. God controls all human history. Now, God is under no compulsion to explain to us what he is doing. Why should he? And God doesn't always explain to us what he is doing. Why has this nation gone the way it has? We don't know. But God is in control. That's the first lesson that we see in this passage. God controls all of human history. The second thing that we find in this passage, which really is a corollary of the first thing, and that is this, that God sets up kings and disposes kings. This is what Daniel says in that psalm of praise when the vision and its meaning was declared to him. It says in verse 20, Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belongs wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings to give wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding." In other words, God controls the affairs of each nation. That's what Daniel is saying here. Daniel is saying that the people of Israel, they in the Old Testament are God's people, yes, and the nation of Israel is God's nation, yes, but it doesn't mean that God has no jurisdiction outside of Israel. Here he's looking at all this, and I think it certainly seems to have struck Daniel with great force. Perhaps Daniel had never really thought this through. And then the interpretation is given to him, and it strikes him with great force. That God controls all things. God controls the rulers of the nations. God controls which kingdom is going to come next. And God appoints kings and God disposes kings. Because when the meaning of the vision is made clear to him, he's understood this. That it is God who raised up Nebuchadnezzar. It is God who gave military power to the Babylonian kingdom. It is God who brought the Babylonian kingdom to Jerusalem. Well, we know that because in chapter 1 we read that the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. It is God who brought Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. And it is God who gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. And Daniel then understands that one day there will come a time when God will dispose the Babylonian kingdom. It has served its purpose. And he disposes of that and he raises a new kingdom, the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. And he gives power to Cyrus, the king of the Medes and the Persians. And so the Medes and the Persians are now the superpower. And they serve their purpose. And when they have served their purpose, he disposes of them. And he gives power to the Greeks. He raises up Alexander the Great. And he gives military might and strategy and strength to Alexander the Great. And so Alexander the Great builds his kingdom. And it is God who is behind all of this. And when Alexander the Great and when the Greeks have served their purpose, they go and up come the Romans. And God gives them military strength and wisdom in war and so on. And so they become the superpower and they rule over a large area of land. And all of this is God appointing kings and disposing kings. The sovereignty of God, I've made this point before, particularly in the book of Daniel, the sovereignty of God is a major theme. It will come up again and again and again. And isn't that interesting? That when God's people are living in this hostile environment, when all around them is hostile to their faith, that God consistently and repeatedly says to them from his word that he is sovereign, he is in charge. Clearly, that's an important lesson for us in Britain in the 21st century. God is in control. Because I think we Christians can be a little bit like the people of Daniel's day. Well, God has lost control. It's the Babylonians who are in control. Nebuchadnezzar seems to have so much power. He has all this military strength. He has walked into Jerusalem. He's besieged the city. He's defeated the city. He's destroyed the temple. Look at the power he has. Well, our God seems to have lost power. Because we go by what we see. And we allow what we see and what we hear, we allow these things to determine how we think. And the book of Daniel consistently says, you don't go by what you see. You go by what God has revealed. And God is sovereign. And he sets up kings. And he disposes kings. So that's the second thing in this passage. God controls all of human history. God sets up kings and disposes kings. And then thirdly and finally, the main theme of my sermon, God is building his kingdom here on earth. The vision of this man, head of gold and silver and bronze and iron and clay and so on. But in the middle of all of this, as part of this vision, he says in verse 34, as you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand. And it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the earth. And in his explanation of it, he says in verse 44, and in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and it broke in pieces all the other kingdoms. So Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, you're looking at all these political events, you're looking at all these historical events that are going to happen. And Daniel says, you've got to remember that in the middle of all of this, in the midst of all this, while there is the Babylonian kingdom and the Persians and the Medes and the Greeks and the Romans, and they're coming and going and they're doing all their invading and everything that they did, in the midst of all of this, God is building his kingdom. And it's very interesting, you know, when you look at history, that actually all these kingdoms played a part. You have the people of Judah there in Jerusalem. And it's very interesting when you read the history of the Old Testament people. Before the Babylonian exile, there is no question, the Bible makes this very clear, they were idolaters. They would go off into idolatry. Baal and Ashtoreth and all these other idols were a great attraction to them. They would go off into idolatry. The Bible tells us that. But then the exile came and they went into Babylon for 70 years. And they suffered much in Babylon. It was a dreadful time. By the rivers of Babylon, there we wept. And idolatry was cleansed out of them. Stuart Olliott says, they wept idolatry out of their system. You never read of Israel going into idolatry after the exile. I'm not saying they became perfect. Not saying they became sinless. But you don't, after the exile, read of them worshipping idols. So the Babylonian kingdom obviously had a purpose in God building his kingdom. He wanted these people cleansed of this habit of idolatry, and he obviously used the Babylonian kingdom for that. And idolatry, as Olliott says, they wept it out of their system. You don't read of idolatry again after the exile. Then come the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. And you read about how when Darius or Cyrus, when he became king, issues this decree, and they go back from Babylon to Jerusalem, financed by the Persian kingdom to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. Because remember, the city had been destroyed, the temple had been destroyed, and the people were carried off as exiles. And it's in the purposes of God that they should return to their land, rebuild their temple, and reestablish true religion. And the Persians and the Medes, you read this in the book of Ezra, financed that return and the building work. So it seems that they had this purpose, they had this role to play in the purposes of God, that they should finance the rebuilding of Jerusalem, because that was part of God building his kingdom. One day the Messiah was to come from the Jews, and the Jews had to be freed of idolatry, and the Jews had to return to their home, to their worship. And then come the Greeks. And the Greeks spread this kingdom, and the language, it's very clear when Jesus came, that the entire known world spoke one language, Greek. Now, of course, they had their local languages as well. I expect the Egyptians had an Egyptian language, and the Turks had the Turkish language, and the other nations around had their own language as well. But Greek was obviously the lingua franca. It was this language that was broadly used by the empire. And of course, this was in the time of Jesus, and then when the Holy Spirit came on the day of Pentecost, and the disciples went out, and Paul does his missionary journeys. And Paul then doesn't have to go to Galatia and learn a Galatian language. They speak Greek. Second missionary journey, Paul goes to Greece. Well, of course, they speak Greek. And third missionary journey, he goes to Ephesus, which is in Turkey. They speak Greek. Because Greek is widely spoken, and it facilitates the spread of the language, of the gospel. And everywhere they go, Greek is spoken. Because Alexander has taken his kingdom to this vast area. And then come the Romans. And the Romans set up this kingdom, where there was a road system, and there was security, and there was peace. And so Paul could leave his church in Antioch and travel to what is today southwestern Turkey without crossing any borders. It's one kingdom. And there was a road system to take him there, and a system of boats on the Mediterranean to take him there. And there was safety. You don't read of them being attacked on the roads. There was safety. He could go into these places and preach the gospel. Second missionary journey, he goes all the way into Greece. You look at the map where he starts from in Antioch, and he covers the whole width of Turkey. It's a huge country. He covers the whole width of Turkey and goes into Greece and goes all the way down the Greek peninsula to Corinth, second missionary journey. You don't read anywhere that he fell among thieves, he was attacked, or there was no road system, or anything like that. The Romans had set up this Pax Romana, a peace over the whole kingdom, and a road system which could be used. And third missionary journey, he goes to Ephesus, right in the southwestern corner of Turkey. Again, travels there, no problem getting there. Yes, there was opposition to the gospel, but they did live in security and in peace because the Roman emperor brought that. You know, there are two ways of looking at Britain in the 21st century. You could say it's all terrible, 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 terrible. You could say, I wonder how God is going to use what's happening today for the building of his kingdom. Because God is building his kingdom. It's there. And Jesus said much the same thing. He used different language. He spoke about the mustard seed becoming the largest of our trees. But this idea of God building his kingdom. I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And even Britain in the 21st century, with all its ungodliness, its unbiblical behavior, its rebellion, somehow God uses all these things for the building of his kingdom. And we should actually think of it like that, you know. We should pray about this. It's very easy to become negative. It's very easy to look at everything from a negative perspective and to be discouraged about everything. It's very easy. But faith doesn't do that. Faith takes hold of God. Faith believes in God. Faith takes hold of the word of God. I will build my church. And the kingdom of God is like the mustard seed, which is the smallest of your seeds, but becomes the largest of your trees. And faith says God is at work. And I will pray. And I will be active. Because God is building his kingdom here on earth. So friends, let's take hold of this. God is sovereign. And God is building his kingdom. Even in the most hostile nation on earth, let us remember that God is building his kingdom here on earth.